welcome to the Parley podcast. We are here to discuss the impact of the recent disclosures made by the State Bank of India about the electoral bond scheme. To discuss the issue, we have with us ex-IAS and former Finance and Economic Affairs Secretary, Mr. Subhash Chandra Garg. And he has also authored many books such as the $10 trillion dream and commentary on budget 2020-24, and we also make policy. Welcome, sir. And we also have with us Ms. Anjali Bharatwaj, the founder of Sarthak Nagarik Sangathan, a group that has used RTI Act extensively to bring out many previously unknown information, a firm believer that information brings about real change. Ma'am, we have used your information for data points also many times in the section. Yeah, so thank you so much for that. So both of you have commented extensively on this scheme since its start. So today we are going to ask you some specific questions which have emerged after the latest round of disclosures. So if you can comment on that. So we'll go to the first question, which I wanted to put across, is the recent revelations in many papers, including ours, have said that many firms that faced ED and IT searches purchased bonds worth crores of rupees. Especially, most of these were, brought after such an action took place, right? And most of this fund went to the ruling party in the center, which is the BJP. Some amounts also went to, ruling parties in various states. It spread around. So this has led to some of them saying that the scheme is a means for extortion. Do you agree with this view, or we are reading too much into this? If we can start with Anjali, ma'am.
Well, the first thing I think that we need to understand is that these disclosures are being viewed by people, and there are several trends that are emerging. Finally, to be able to say with certainty what was happening and to conclude if there was a quid pro quo or any kind of extortion, there will need to be a deep probe and investigation to be able to establish everything in a conclusive manner. But yes, what does seem to be appearing from the data that has been now put in the public domain on electoral bonds is that a lot of companies seem to have been under the scrutiny of the Enforcement Directorate, the CBI, IT department. There were raids. And in close proximity of that happening, they have bought electoral bonds. And these electoral bonds, much of those bonds have also been donated to the ruling party at the center, which is the Bharatiya Janata Party. Now, this could point towards two types of things. One is whether the question that arises then is that was there any form of extortion where an agency would have perhaps been used to target any company to then try and extract funds from them. The other thing which is possible is that there were cases going on against these companies, but then these companies go ahead and they make donations to the ruling party in the hope that the investigations against them, the agencies go slow or they are dropped. So again, all of this will have to be a subject matter of deeper investigation, but certainly these questions are arising and they are very legitimate questions which are emerging from the data.
I understand. So, sir, would you like to respond to that and also give your original thoughts on this matter?
See, my sense is, and I trust the kind of investigative analysis which the civil society organizations and others are doing now, after the electoral bond data has become available. And that must be true. It's possible to connect the actions of the investigative agencies in terms of either ED or the CBI, in terms of the dates on which they acted, raided, because these also are publicly available. And now with the bond data becoming also publicly available in terms of the dates on which those were bought and the political parties to which they were donated. So it's possible now to make these connections. But believe me, I think the guys who donated electoral bonds in such cases perhaps trusted the anonymity which these bonds were designed to provide much more than what we are today. So if in my judgment, and I'm only speculating, I have no means to verify, that if they had not trusted this anonymity, perhaps they would have not used the electoral bond route to provide this. So I think the civil society organizations may actually think, though it was not intentionally designed, but maybe this is the unintentional fallout of the now demonized electoral bond scheme, that this information, this connection is actually becoming possible. If it was not there, the electoral bond scheme was not there, the donations would have still perhaps been made, but in form and manner which would have been untraceable. So I think the civil society organizations may thank the electoral bond scheme for enabling this to happen.
That's greatly put. So the second question also is somewhat related to this. There was also another pattern which we could see and others have sensed as well, where strong correlations can be seen between firms making large donations and then immediately them receiving high-value government contracts, or just before giving those bonds, they may have got contracts. Is it also correct to treat these cases as quid pro quo, or is this have always been there that we are reading too much into it because suddenly electoral bond revelations have been made? Sir, how do you see this? Because you said in the last answer that maybe we are reading it too much more into this than required.
See, I've said this a number of occasions. If you live in a real pragmatic world, the quid pro quo is absolutely common. The businessmen, the companies don't donate for any higher or ethical or to promote democracy in the country. They make contributions precisely to serve their business interest. It may be in different forms, as you mentioned, sometimes to get contracts, sometimes to play gratefulness or pay gratefulness for receiving the contracts, sometimes to get protection, sometimes to get their skins saved from the actions or whatever. So the presence of quid pro quo is something which I won't at all rule out. In fact, that might be the raison d'etre of these donations being made. What I would say is that the same businessmen or same companies were not willing to make political donations under the scheme which existed before, which continue to exist now, where you fully disclose. Why did they make the donations under the scheme, and which enabled them to actually use the company funds officially and invite to make those donations, is perhaps the belief in that guarantee that they would not know, or no one would know, that who they donated to. In fact, during the discussion phase of the scheme, this had come up as the most prominent reason why the electoral bond scheme should be brought about. They, in fact, many businessmen had also complained to the then finance minister, who also happened to be a treasurer of that party for many years, that yes, we have to make donations, but if we can make donations without converting our white money into black cash and give you the donation in cash, provided we are protected from this disclosure that who we are going to, and that is what the reason of the scheme was. So I don't deny the presence of the quid pro quo. Only thing the electoral bond enabled was that, of course, that quid pro quo was perhaps being serviced, but in a more transparent manner. You have on both ends the disclosure from the companies, from its own funds, and the disclosures from the political parties that we have received this much funds, which they can spend in white by issuing checks or making payments digitally from their own accounts. So it was definitely quid pro quo, but in a more transparent manner.
Right. Ma'am, would you like to respond to that question?
Yes. Certainly, this is something that has also been, documented in the judgment that the Supreme Court has given, that when large corporations, companies are giving money, it is so that they can, in return, get a favor. And it's almost like an investment. And that is really what is quid pro quo. Quid pro quo takes many forms. It takes the form of kickbacks. It takes the form of extortion. It takes the form of go slow on certain cases, etc. So it could be many ways in which this could be functioning. And one of them, of course, would be to be able to get contracts from the ruling party or those in power. So when we are seeing this trend in the data that has now emerged, one can say that it is showing that there is quid pro quo. Again, like I said, deeper investigation finally shows, can only show what was actually happening, how it was done, and so on. But yes, it points towards a certain quid pro quo. And there are lots of companies who seem to be getting very large contracts very soon before or after they give money through electoral bonds. Now, let me say one thing over here. It's absolutely true that quid pro quo is nothing new. And in fact, when we said that political party funding has been the fountainhead of corruption in our country, that's really what a lot of it is about, that, these companies are able to give money to political parties and then make sure that they make policies, laws, give contracts, not for public interest, but for the interest of those companies. And I think, was very clearly happening before electoral bonds came as well. Some of it was happening through the banking channels, and a lot of it was also happening through cash. Now, it is, of course, also true that unless somebody caught someone red-handed, it was impossible to establish this kind of quid pro quo. But the problem that came with the electoral bonds was that earlier, whereas citizens, regulators had information about what money was coming through the banking channel, through the electoral bonds, even that information became opaque. It became inaccessible to citizens. And even in the Supreme Court, when this issue was being debated, and one of the main contentions of the government counsel was that this was brought in to reduce cash so that, because of the anonymity clause, those who wanted to give back cash would be encouraged now to give through the banking channel. The questions that the court asked, there were two clear questions. One, the court asked that with the electoral bond scheme being initiated, has there been any ban on accepting cash? And to which the answer clearly was no. So along with electoral bonds, the whole system of donation through cash continued alongside. The second thing, which I think was really something which many of us had a problem with, was that although expressly it was forbidden to trade electoral bonds, in reality, there were no safeguards to trade these bonds. So what that really meant was that somebody who had money in the bank could buy, by giving their KYC, these electoral bonds, but they could be traded for a consideration, and someone who had cash could buy these bonds, and effectively that money gets laundered, and it is still the black money that is circulating in the system. So that is what the court also took into account while declaring these unconstitutional, because then the court said that the proportionality test, when it was applied, it was felt that whatever benefits might have been potentially accrued by shifting the cash donations elsewhere. The kind of loss in terms of people's right to know, Article 19 violation, that loss far outweighed any benefit that could have come from it. So I think that these are the various things that the court kept in mind and we are seeing now. So these details have not come out by design. In fact, Mr. Garg is here and, you know, he will certainly know that these details were never supposed to be in the public domain. They were supposed to be full anonymity. Had there not been a Supreme Court judgment to say that these bonds are unconstitutional and that there should be retrospective, you know, declaration of information, citizens would never have known what was happening. And if the SBI had actually not recorded the alphanumeric unique numbers on both sides, we wouldn't have known. So it is really by accident rather than by design, and which is why we say that if we are looking for an instrument to improve the system, which really needed improvement, then the electoral bond scheme and the electoral bonds as they were conceived was not the correct.
Can I put some of these things into the context, right? See, the argument that when this electoral bond scheme was brought in, the cash donation should have been stopped, right? I think that's a very inaccurate argument for two reasons. Number one, the part of the cash donations are also as transparent as any other donations, which is given if given for more than 20,000 rupees a donation. So in that case, you have to say that who is giving the donation, and the political party also has to declare before the election commission that who did they receive it from. So cash as such is not a villain. I think sometimes we in today's life, though for centuries humanity has lived by cash, today we are trying to sort of demonize cash as something inherently bad. So the 20,000 plus donation was completely transparent, right? It was smaller in amount, that is the problem, but not that the cash donation of 20,000 rupees or more given was a problem. It's completely transparent. The government did bring it down, the limit of 20,000 to 2,000 rupees at that time, that any donation henceforth, given if it is more than 2,000 rupees, you have to declare, right? Only small donation of less than 2,000 was kept in cash. This was as good as banning the cash. I think the court misread the entire sequence and understanding about this. But the real proof, we have this notion that if you statutorily ban something, the whole thing gets, you can wish it away. We banned the child marriages before 16 years of age, 105, 115 years back. It doesn't go away, right? Banning is not the ultimate answer to getting any social or political evil go away. But the proof of pudding is in eating, right? After the electoral bond scheme came, the cash donations reduced drastically. That's on record now, right? So I think this entire argument about cash was perhaps not correct in my judgment. Now, the second thing about the political or the rights of the people to know, this, as I have said before, was the fundamental feature to make the companies make donation, that the link between them and the political parties, they might be facing retributions or they might be fearing anything or the other. That was the critical feature. So if you take away the critical feature, then it becomes like any other, the other company law scheme. So, and I think how much should we associate with individual citizens' right to know who donated to whom? By the way, all the banking transactions which the companies do are not placed in the public domain. Who they buy from, who do they sell from, what is their patents, what are their other rights, confidential secrets, etc., etc. And forget about public, even the government and others have no right to know and break into the privacy of the commercial transactions of the companies. The fact that the people were able to get this much information that, yes, this political party has received this much contribution and the companies made this much contribution, because companies disclosed in their own accounts all the political donations they made. So I think this much was a sufficient transparency in my judgment. I have no quarrel with the idealistic view about the life that this is the way it should be. But my only argument is that that ideal should be realizable in practice. And if that ideal is not realizable, that ideal is not the real ideal. One more thing I would say, which we in India, I think, have made a kind of fascination. We are fascinated by it in a wrong sense. Our culture of doing business in the country is very heavily interfered by the government. The government is everywhere. You tax it very high. You have so many regulations which the businessmen have to be. And the government is also a very major player in the business space, on the electricity side or on infrastructure side, you take it. The government is the buyer. So the people have to, or the businessmen have to get the business perforce from the government. Likewise, we have many schemes like you take the PLI or semiconductors or whatnot, where the government gives you so much of high subsidies that you have to think of doing something to please the government to give it to you or to act in your favor. So the electoral bonds is a kind of symptoms of that sorry state of affairs of doing business in the country. It's not good, to my mind, to blame the businessmen and the companies only for this. I think if we can make our national business, doing business kind of thing, not easy, which the government claims many times of having done, but actually making it easier and away from the government to do business, I think that will bring the real change.
But the third question actually is somewhat related to this. So, see, yes, I take your point that we can't, you know, go after businesses and, you know, call them that they are bad and because they have to go through all these things. But there are some very specific instances where we found out that firms donated crores just months after getting incorporated. This happened in many firms in Hyderabad. Most of these firms are actually in Hyderabad. And firms which started during the pandemic, which is 2020-21, and immediately in about a year or so, they donated about 30 crores, 40 crores. And it went to a variety of parties. Companies, many of the companies, so we went through, because, for example, most of the companies which we know, we just left it. And then we went after the companies which we have never even heard of. Most of the companies did not exist. They do not have a website. And we couldn't find the exact name of the company in the Ministry of Corporate Affairs. So maybe they changed their names after donating. I'm not sure. So we are still investigating that. So, and also there are these cases of companies which are going through severe losses during, you know, pandemic especially. But their donations in that period were about 50 crores or more. So this brings us to this question of, before electoral bond scheme came in, there were some specific caps. Like, for example, you can only donate 7.5% of your profit, and you cannot donate if you are making losses. There were so many stipulations put on the way, the type of companies which can donate and when they can donate. Do you think the lifting of these caps, you know, have impacted, I mean, had a bad effect in this? What do you think about these findings? I will take, sir, if you can respond first.
All right. So, see, the anonymity which was to be built into between the donor and the political party was in normal case could have been considered sufficient if the company donated to the political party it wanted to do, right? But it's a great country. Some people may not have thought that that's sufficient layer of protection or anonymity for them. The idea behind abolishing the restrictions on loss-making companies to make political donation and lifting that cap of 7.5% from the profits limit was again precisely rooted in the kind of description which I was making of creating a level playing field for the companies. Now, I am not persuaded. Many people may not agree with this viewpoint, but I am not persuaded why a loss-making company should be denied from making political donations. In many cases, the loss-making company and a profit-making company might actually be the competitors. And if we have belief in the kind of discussions we were having earlier, that there is generally quid pro quo is present if you're competing for contracts or whatever. Now, doesn't it amount to the loss-making company being handicapped or its hands and legs tied in comparison to the company which is making profit while competing for the same contracts and others? I might sound a little skeptical or of that type, but that's not the case. I would like you to appreciate the real state of the affair. And for maybe the kind of instances which you have discovered where some companies were sort of incorporated only a day or before their names have been changed, I think it will be good to get the data now, since all the data is available, that what is that proportion? Is it 5%? Is it 10%? Or is it 50% of the donations which have come through? This another indirect or secondary layer, right? Where people, because now with that lift, that curb on the loss-making companies having been lifted, some businessman might have thought it, that why not incorporate another company? And route it through that, because there is no limit on the loss making or there is no profit making, profit cap. And you would have another one layer for making the donations unknown. Now, these are hardcore businessmen, guys, who are sitting out in the open. They may have many considerations. But to my mind, it doesn't on its own disclose any criminality. I think it should be possible with all the data about the companies being available to trace that this company was floated by this company. If you are getting civil contracts or the irrigation contracts in many places, right, you might create X company, Y company. If you want to donate to a political party in the state in which you are operating or another state you are operating. So there may be many reasons why people resorted to it. But to my mind, it does not on its own disclose any criminality.
Ma'am, would you like to respond to that and also your original thoughts on this question?
Yes. So let me actually start by saying one or two things. One is that the electoral bond scheme was not brought in a vacuum. There were at least four laws that were amended before the electoral bond scheme was brought in to facilitate the introduction of electoral bonds. And each of those has been examined by the Supreme Court in its judgment and held to be unconstitutional, three of them at least. One was, of course, what you referred to, which was the amendment that was made to the Companies Act. Now, let us be very clear. The Companies Act earlier, and in fact, now it has been restored, basically said that only companies which were profit-making could make donations to political parties. And even those donations had to be limited to 7.5% of the previous 3 years, the average of the previous 3 years of profits that they made. Now, this is something which is globally accepted that, you know, profit-making companies are allowed where corporate donations are allowed to political parties. Because, you know, I mean, even if one were to think of it intuitively, why would a loss-making company make a donation? You know, there can be no other reason that they are not being able to even make a profit for their shareholders, but they actually cough up crores of rupees to give to political parties. It has to be for a quid pro quo. It's almost a given. So let me put another issue here, which I think you alluded to, which is the whole issue of shell companies, where even before the laws were amended, and certainly before the electoral bond scheme was brought in 2018, the Reserve Bank of India, at that time, Mr. Urjit Patel was the governor of the Reserve Bank, he wrote in repeated letters that, you know, there was this worry that this system of electoral bonds will lead to generation of black money. The Election Commission of India said that it would lead, especially this IT company, the Companies Act amendment, will lead to the creation of shell companies which are made solely with the purpose of making donations to political parties. Because what then could potentially happen was that if somebody wanted to give money to a political party, then they would just set up a company, which could be like a fly-by-night operator. They would make a donation through electoral bonds, and then, you know, it would become much more difficult to trace that donation. So this kind of finding that you're referring to is therefore not surprising. It was something that was argued by the petitioners also in the Supreme Court, and something that the Supreme Court did take into account as well before when all of this was declared unconstitutional. Now, the problem, let me just respond to some of the things that Mr. Garg has said as well. You know, the problem is that when we say that there was a cap, there was a limit of 20,000 rupees in cash, in fact, let me not say in cash, but there was a limit of 20,000 rupees under which if a donation was made, the name of the person who was making the donation did not have to be disclosed. Now, we know it was an open secret that all political parties, when they took large amounts of cash from a company, instead of saying that they were getting 100 crores or 1,000 crores, whatever, in cash, they would simply break it down into smaller packets of 19,900 rupees and say that, you know, these are all these well-wishers who have given us these small packets of money, and therefore not have to say who gave them the money, whereas it was clearly, let's say, being given by one big corporate. Now, if we look at what was done when the electoral bond scheme was brought in, it is correct that the amount of cash donation was brought down to 2,000 rupees. But all that was required was further creative accounting, where instead of breaking it down into packets of 19,900, it would be 1,990 rupees, to simply say. So what that really meant was that those large donations could carry on simultaneously while also accepting electoral bonds, which further brought much more donations through the banking channels into the domain of anonymity. That, I think, is something that is very important to understand. The second thing, you know, it's something which has been said that the amount of cash went down. Now, cash is often not even declared by political parties. So what we see in terms of declarations by way of cash, you know, through the decades, has not been the entire amount that a political party gets. It is, you know, I mean, so we don't know how much a BJP or a Congress or any other party was getting before or was getting during the electoral bond scheme was on. So what we can see, however, if you were to examine, you know, the statement, the financial statement of the BJP, last year, their declared income, 54% of their declared income came from electoral bonds. Now, you see, parties do need today, when they're going into so much expensive electioneer campaigning, election campaigning, and building big buildings or offices, etc., different parties, they do need to declare income. What this became was really a way to be able to legitimately show that, look, we have got this money, and therefore don't say that, you know, you don't even have the money, how are you spending it? So this really did seem to have become a very significant source of funding for that reason. But did it actually lead to a reduction in the cash that was flowing in, or was this in addition, is anybody's guess. Now, another thing which I think is worth pointing out here is that a lot of people are saying that we were expecting that when the electoral bonds data came, it would be full of the large corporates that we all kind of expect fund political parties. It could be anybody. It could be Tatas, Ambanis, Adanis, Birlas, anyone. And when we are seeing the data today, you know, most of these names are conspicuous by their absence. So two things are really something that people are today wondering. One is that were donations through electoral bonds made through shell companies, or they did not make these donations through electoral bonds at all? Or was it that cash donations were being made earlier and they continued to be made even during the electoral bonds? So you see, what I think is important to understand is that the express objective of the electoral bonds were twofold. One was to reduce cash and black money, and the other was to increase transparency in political party funding. Unfortunately, the second one, you know, there can be little argument that it wasn't providing greater transparency. And of course, today we have that information only thanks to the fact that the whole scheme has been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. But whether shell companies were being used, and this amendment to the Companies Act was being used to, in fact, you know, channel money into political parties and, you know, give a greater sort of, you know, fillip to the to black money, is a question that came up earlier and continues to remain when these disclosures are in the public domain now.
I need to make certain clarifications on this as well. So this is, I think Anjali said perfectly fine, the cash was the dominant, and there is no way we can have any evidence whether the cash got reduced or not reduced. In fact, she obliquely referred to what was the bigger concern at that time as well, is that a good part of the cash funding is not even recorded, not even as the less than 20,000 or less than 2,000. And that goes to the political party personnel, office bearers, netas, etc. And how do they account for, where do they spend it? It also becomes their personal wealth or personal means to do their personal expenditures, etc. Right. So the cash, the culprit part of the cash, which is unaccounted, or the less than 2,000 or styled as less than 20,000 or 2,000, it remains problematic. I have no defense for that. The electoral bond scheme, or the guys who sort of designed and implemented it, were never living in a world where they believed that the cash donations would go away. The only intention was that if a good part of it, we don't know what part, but if a good part of that gets channelized into the electoral bond, you might have improvement to that extent that the office bearers will not receive cash and will make payments in cash, will not use the cash for their personal purposes or their personal ends and all. So to that extent, this was never the aim, that the electoral bond scheme can eliminate or will eliminate cash. And to my mind, to the extent the electoral bond donations came, I think cash to that extent can be presumed to have been reduced through that. I have one more clarification, because Anjali said a couple of times about this shell company. She referred to Urjit Patel's writing, Election Commission writing. These were all on record. In fact, I have described them in great detail in my book. There is a chapter on electoral bond. Urjit Patel's, or before that, the RBI's, were two concerns with it. One was a very genuine concern that this can be used as a bearer bond, as a currency kind of thing. It can be laundered, can be used. And that was a very genuine, because it's a bearer kind of note, promissory note. We sat together with the Reserve Bank and thought about how do we sort of reduce that risk. And it was agreed, and I'm saying with responsibility, that is agreed by RBI, that if they wanted 7 days sort of life of the electoral bond, we said 7 days will be impossible to implement, because you have to buy, take delivery, deliver it. The political party has to deposit. And then both sides agreed that if it is 2 weeks or 15 days, that risk is greatly minimized. So Urjit Patel's letter, which is also in public domain, is post this consensus with the RBI, post this agreement. He had a brainwave. I'm saying with responsibility that he had a brainwave that let us design the digital electoral bonds, which only RBI will administer. And this brainwave had come after the scheme parameters were actually agreed with the Reserve Bank and also with the government at the highest level. Now, that brainwave was completely hitting at the root of the electoral bond. If you have a digital footprint left all over, that anonymity which we were looking for was not there, and therefore this was not accepted. And ultimately RBI also agreed. It's not that Urjit Patel did not agree. So Urjit Patel also finally agreed that this is what is the sense. Likewise, about the Election Commission saying about shell companies being used, it defied the intelligence of us all that the shell company's structure was widely prevalent in the older situation, where the companies were transferring profits through or cash through or their incomes through underbilling, overbilling to other companies, which were then converting this into cash or something. Now, when the company itself is allowed, and as I said earlier, more than 90%, 95% of the donation is made directly by the company concerned. Maybe 5-10% might have been done. So when you are allowed to do it directly on your company's account, using your company's cash or income, why would you create shell company? This defies logic. So I, in fact, went to the Election Commission and argued with them, all of them. And finally, this particular member who had this fear of the ghosts which he was seeing also agreed that yes, this may not. An election commission, of course, they would not ever agree to give it in writing that we are fine with it, but they withheld their objections thereafter. So this fear or ghost of the shell companies or the cash remaining in the system is overplayed. I don't think this stands the scrutiny of what it is. It's fine now. Electoral bond scheme by design had that anonymity. That's why, or SBI by mistake, in my judgment, recorded this. The data is available. Fair enough. Use this data for finding out who was making donation to whom. But creating the fears of cash not being eliminated or shell companies being more favorably situated in case of the electoral bond scheme is completely untrue.
Right. It's duly noted. Let's move on to the second phase of this argument. Yes, all these are about companies and everything. But let's move to the more core of the issue, where the agencies such as ED and IT, which, yes, electoral in terms of electoral bonds or even otherwise, we see a lot of them. There is a talk that's being used by the government for specific purposes. My question is really simple. See, there are some internal mechanisms that these organizations have. For example, the PMLA Act, there is a section called 262, which punishes erring officers. So are they working properly enough to deter officials of the ED and other agencies from, you know, doing vexatious searches? Because, see, I'm asking this very specific question. Maybe Anjali ji can answer this first. Because I filed an RTI and also I went for an appeal. My question was very simple. In the investigations which you have completed, I did not comment on the ongoing investigations. I asked them very specifically, in the investigations which you completed, have any officer been, you know, punished by the section because he or she was found to be, have conducted a vexatious search? They denied that information to me. They said, you know, you are asking about this, ED is not under purview. So that brings me to the second part of the question. One, first part is that are the internal mechanisms, the safeguards, the checks and balances are there in these agencies which stop them from doing such as searches or arrests? Second part of the question is, should the agencies, you know, they are not in the RTI ambit, yes, for good reason, maybe, yes, but should they at least share some details of these cases without harming their investigations in public domain, or at least of the cases which got completed?
Yeah, so let me answer your second question first. Under the RTI Act, even public authorities that are exempt, they are still obligated to provide information that relates to corruption and human rights violation. So I think much of the information that, you know, we seek from a lot of these organizations relates to corruption and human rights violation. And that, I think, should be made available. There is no reason why that should be withheld from citizens, even if, you know, they are in Schedule 24. Now, as for the first part of your question, I think what the data that has been disclosed is showing, like we discussed earlier, is that in many cases, the ED, CBI, IT department, you know, and the ED, CBI are the premier investigating agencies of our country, that they were conducting searches, there were raids, etc. And just before or after that, companies bought electoral bonds. So I think what is clearly being seen is the involvement of these agencies. At the very least, there is an allegation or there is a perception of the involvement of these agencies. Now, that really sort of opens the question on who is going to investigate the investigators. Because if we are saying that a deep investigation is required and we are seeing the names of our premier investigating agencies in these sort of arrangements that appear to be coming out through the data, that is a big concern, which is why a lot of people are today asking for an independent probe, perhaps even a Supreme Court monitored SIT into the matter, so that, you know, we can't really now expect these agencies to investigate these issues themselves. And therefore, I mean, you know, once we have more information, it will also become clear whether Section 62 and other provisions which are meant for the accountability of the officials of these agencies were being effective, were they being used or not. But let me just say one thing here, which I think is very, very important in terms of the disclosures that have come out. I think what we are seeing is a very concerning state of the institutions of our country. Institutions that are supposed to function in public good, for public good and in public interest. We are, of course, seeing that, you know, the SBI, the role of the SBI, the way in which it made all sorts of attempts to not share information before elections. They said that we will give the information despite the Supreme Court judgment. We'll give it. They asked for time, more time, and said we need 4 months to give this information, which when the Supreme Court came down heavily, they have, you know, very quickly provided. I think Mr. Garg has made a very, very important point about what the SBI seems to have done, which is that the very basic structure, at least as far as the government was concerned, or, you know, those who brought in the electoral bonds was concerned, was ensuring anonymity of those who made donations and to whom. And we have... there are documents which clearly show that the SBI was not supposed to record the unique alphanumeric codes, record them at all with any transaction. But what is now very clear is that they were recorded. And in fact, now digital records of it have been made available by the SBI. Now, this hits at the fundamental nature of the scheme for various levels, because one is that what people were made to believe was that there will be complete anonymity, and which meant that as citizens, we won't know, regulators won't know, political parties won't know. And, what we were told was that donors will then be encouraged to move to the banking channel rather than giving money, in cash, because they will not have to fear any kind of retribution. Now, what this is effectively showing is that if a public sector bank, which of course the government and therefore the ruling party of the day will have access, the records will always have access to those records, is actually recording at the stage of purchase and redeeming of those bonds, who is buying those bonds and giving them, that ruling party then has an undue advantage. And that is destroying the level playing field in our democracy in terms of elections, because then donors also, of course, realize once those ultraviolet, under the ultraviolet light, those numbers came in, etc., it did become quite obvious that the SBI could have, and now it is clear that they were keeping a track of who was buying and giving. So naturally, those who wanted to give to political parties who were in the opposition would be worried that they might face adverse action from the ruling party, and which is also one of the reasons why we might be seeing the lion's share of the electoral bonds going to the ruling BJP. So I think that the role of the SBI as not is something which is really coming under a cloud today. The role of the ED, the CBI, the IT department is again something that is a long shadow that has been cast on in this entire electoral bond saga. And finally, I would even go so far as to say that the ECI, the Supreme Court of India, which took 7 years to declare this unconstitutional, allowed one general election to happen using electoral bonds money, allowed state elections to happen for the past 7 years. And now we are going into another general election with the political parties sitting on money that they have garnered using electoral bonds. I think all the institutions have much to answer for.
Yeah, I think ma'am has answered 3 questions together. So I will ask one by one to you, sir, and then I'll come back to you, ma'am.
I've noted what she said. So I'll respond to your question as well as the institutional lapses which the SBI probably committed and the implications about the... So let me begin by saying, Anjali ji, you should bear me out if it is incorrect or correct. The SBI was recording meticulously the alphanumeric number against the buyer and the depositor. This is now confirmed because they themselves declared this data. But was this fact of SBI recording so meticulously in the knowledge of any one of you in the civil society organizations there? My reading of the petitions, the arguments in the Supreme Court, and even the Supreme Court judgment suggest that no one was actually aware of the alphanumeric code and the SBI recording it. Did you ever refer to in your petitions the the alphanumeric code? Did the Supreme Court refer to it in its judgment? Was it brought out in any of the arguments? I think not.
If I may just since this was something that Mr. Garg is asking me, if I may. So the moment the alphanumeric number, the existence of it came to light, you know, the fact that it could be seen under the UV light became clear, I think there was an immediate recognition of the fact, certainly amongst members of civil society, and I'm sure amongst corporates and anyone else who was paying attention, that it was possible to actually link the donor to the recipient of the bond. So who was purchasing it and who was getting this could potentially be traced. And this was repeatedly also mentioned in terms of how they would destroy the level playing field. So initially, nobody knew that there was this unique alphanumeric number, which was recorded on an electoral bond. It was only an investigative journalist who then found this under the UV light. But when once it was done, you know, there was clearly this a recognition that it was possible. Yeah, during the hearings, Mr. Garg, the court did ask the government counsel, the judges asked the Solicitor General that is it possible for the government, the ruling party, to know? And the response was also given that yes, we cannot deny that if there is this thing to let them know it is possible. So I think even during the hearings, this matter did come up. There wasn't a denial.
Anjali ji, that's a different thing. People were fearing, suspecting that the government is in a position to know what the SBI or who is buying from the SBI and who is depositing. This was the sort of apprehension, fear, suspicions all around. I don't deny this. What I am specifically asking you is that was anyone aware or consciously, despite the fact that right in the beginning of the schemes rollout in 2018, somebody published a six-liner note in the in one of the papers saying that it is possible to see this under the ultraviolet light, and that those people came to me also. I said this. They came to us in the finance ministry to say that you have designed this cunning way to actually enable people to trace who is donating to whom. And I remember we sort of put out an official release then at that time saying that yes, there is a code which is for security purpose. This is not to be noted by anyone there. I don't know why, but it seemed that people believed what we said. And the whole issue about the code or the feature died down from 2018, and I'm saying again, to 2024, before this or even after until the Supreme Court declared the judgment, nobody made any mention of the alphanumeric code. So the point I was trying to make in the connection of SBI, that SBI might have acted against the scheme's core feature, but it did this so well and in such a secretive manner that no one actually knew. And that is perhaps was the reason why the donors kept donating. And people were speculating that this information might become available to the ruling party, but actually that information was not available. And this is evidenced by the fact that only 50% of the electoral bonds went to BJP. 50% went to others. Under no scheme, this low proportion has gone to the ruling party at the center. Now, therefore, we may, depending upon where we stand, we may believe that the SBI was directed by the government or not directed by the government, or SBI was providing information to the ruling party. But I don't think it was being done, because if you trust the ruling party to be what it is, it would not have stopped getting 50%. I don't want to directly answer the ED and the implications, the motivations, the internal, but I need to say this one thing. And this again is partly directed to Anjali ji. I understand the civil society's pique and discomfort about whatever little or more opaqueness was built in the electoral bond and the fundamental right of the people being sort of violated. But what about the EDs of the world, which are designed to violate the fundamental right of life and liberty, right? And which has adopted the processes which are completely against, or which are substantially against, what we define as the due process of law, right? Why are you not agitating against it? Is this less of a black box than the electoral bonds were? I'll just leave it at that.
Right. No, so that's actually, I understand, Mr. Garg, all these questions, but there are some very specifically two instances with which I think we can end this podcast. That SBI asked for 4 months to link these two numbers, but we managed to do it in 2 hours. So that is one thing which was a very specific instance. So them asking for 4 months and we are able to do it in 2 hours. And there was one more instance where the finance ministry initially claimed that the numbers were not recorded anywhere, which they specifically said, I think, as you mentioned, I think it was a security feature. We are not recording it. I think you also mentioned it in one or two instances in the past, where at least even if it in the buying end, maybe it's there when it is redeemed, I don't think it is recorded. But the latest disclosures show that they were recorded indeed. So, yes, I understand there are so many speculations. The party, the ruling party may have asked something, may not have asked. All those are speculations. But these are very two specific instances which are on record, and something contradicting has come out now. Would you like to specifically comment on that? And with that, we can close.
No, I think there is no contradiction. The scheme did not recognize the alphanumeric code as a identifier. It was not supposed to exist for anyone. This was a security feature in case you need to detect whether some fake bond has come or not. I'll ask you a very simple question. In our currency notes, we have as many as 15 to 70 security features. Do we mention them anywhere? Do we record them anywhere? Do we acknowledge? We say that there are security features, but that's good enough. So whenever the government answered in parliament or otherwise saying that there is no identifier, the alphanumeric code were not meant to be identifier. These were not the identification number. In retrospect, perhaps we might regret in a way of building a number as a security feature. It might have been perhaps more in accordance with the scheme's genius, so to say, of building some picture or building some other way of a security code which you can't digitize and write, which the bumbling SBI seems to have done. But as I said earlier, the SBI unauthorizedly recorded this number, but it recorded perhaps so confidentially that no one knew it.
Right.
So it's fine.
I take that answer. Ma'am, would you like to respond to this very specific question and then we can just close it? That do you think this is a contradiction, because there was a very specific thing which is being said? So SBI is saying 4 months, but it is easier to do. It is. So it's a little bit questionable to you, or, and the second question is them claiming very specifically that these are not recorded, and then immediately in 2 days or 3 days, under a week after he asked, these things are released. So do you think this shows a contradiction or it's not?
I would say that yes, it's very questionable that the SBI, when it had data which it could have collated within hours came back, despite the Supreme Court giving them 3 weeks to provide that data. It came back to say that they needed 4 more months to do it. And, you know, sort of came back on the pretext that they were asked to do matching of these numbers, whereas of the bonds, whereas that was not even the exercise that the Supreme Court had asked them to do. So, yes, the matching also, which they claimed would require 4 months, clearly required just a few hours. So the role of the SBI in terms of misinforming the Supreme Court and attempting to not disclose the information that it was asked specifically to disclose is something that needs to be examined. And this is, this becomes very significant because the date that they were saying they will disclose the information is after the elections, 30th of June, whereas the Supreme Court was basically saying that this involved voters' right to information. So the whole purpose of saying that information should be provided within 3 weeks was so that people could engage with the information before elections. So that is one thing. The other, which I think is equally serious to my mind, is linked to what Mr. Garg has said. And again, the intention behind that exercise is something which will need to be examined. And I really do believe that it deserves a probe in itself, is that if indeed the way in which the alphanumeric code was supposed to be used was a security feature and not for the purpose of an audit trail, then this kind of recording the number, the alphanumeric code on both the purchaser and the depositor side really compromised the very basic structure of the electoral bond scheme and was something which, because it's a government bank, made this information potentially available to the ruling party, therefore destroying the level playing field through electoral bonds. So I think both these things are very serious and they need to be investigated. And I think citizens do have a right to know how the SBI was functioning in this entire saga as well.
Point taken, ma'am. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining. There were 2 excellent views. I think readers will be largely benefit from this.